From 12 News, this is Newsmakers.
Welcome to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White alongside 12 News politics editor Ted Nisi. This week, we thought it would be appropriate to talk about supply chain issues in retail shopping. And joining us are two experts. We have Professor Diane McCrowan from Johnson & Wales University and Professor Teresa McCarthy Byrne from Bryant University. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
We're taping this on a Wednesday, so happy Thanksgiving, 24 hours in advance. So look, Teresa, we're going to start with you. Everyone is freaking out that the gift they ordered won't be here in time for the holidays. There is a significant supply chain issue impacting the global marketplace. First, you know, just sort of walk us through what is going on behind all that and put it into perspective, if you could. Is this among the worst it's been in recent history?
Oh, it's absolutely the worst it's been in history, in recent history, certainly. You know, the supply chain issues stem from production shortages, from factory shutdowns, COVID-related shutdowns in China and Vietnam, and then we also have just as supply is dwindling or is constrained, we have pent-up demand, so demand is increasing, so tremendous supply-demand imbalance. And the increased demand is coming from several things, some from stimulus money, a lot from increased wages, and then we also have increased savings for those families that aren't traveling or dining out as much. So we've got a lot more cash, expendable cash, and so demand is increasing. So then we've got tremendous port congestions at the major ports, LA and Long Beach, Savannah. We've got where we typically maybe have maybe a one ship wait for a cargo vessel to gain a berth. We've got 60, 70, 80 ships waiting in the harbor to get a berth.
I do have one question before we bring in Diane Teresa, which is I've just been seeing in recent days, I would say, some of the big retailers starting to say, oh, actually, we think our supplies have started to catch up. And I was surprised because we've heard so much about shortages. What do you make of that? Are things catching up just in time for some of these retailers?
We are going to see a lot of those goods in the harbor are eventually going to be offloaded and delivered. But a lot of these larger retailers also, they thought in advance that something like this might happen. And so some of the major, you know, certainly Walmart, Target, IKEA, some of the really large retailers. I even know one off-price retailer that collaborated with Dollar Tree, and they chartered their own cargo vessels. So they didn't have to vie for cargo capacity. And so they had the entire capacity of that cargo vessel. Of course, that's only going to work with a larger retailer that can fill up the entire vessel. And they started that months ago, many months ago. So those goods are here. The smaller retailers like, you know, Lululemon and maybe the Gap are air freighting goods. Of course, it's all going to cost a lot more money.
And when we get into a conversation later about inflation, that folds into it because the increase in getting products overseas is so expensive. Diane, Ted had me read a Wall Street Journal article that I found fascinating that the pandemic, basically the thrust of the story was the pandemic may have actually been good for some brick and mortar retailers by thinning out their inventory so they didn't have to lean into, you know, discounting prices so much. Is that what you're seeing as well?
We're definitely seeing that in the brick and mortar stores because they have less merchandise and it's been thinned out. They're selling at more of a profit and their gross margins are better for the brick and mortar stores. So it has helped our brick and mortar stores. What also has helped them is that we moved online for a lot of shopping last year.
Why would that help them?
Well, because this year we want to go back into the stores and we want to have the experience. So this year they're expecting about 65% more shoppers will actually be in brick and mortar stores. And so we'll still see a lot of...
Just so I get the context, in 2020 or 2019?
2021, we'll see more brick and mortar shoppers as compared to 2020.
Okay, yep.
So where we stayed away from stores last year, this year we're really looking for the Christmas that we had before COVID And to have that Christmas, we want to go back in the stores and we want to see the holiday decorations and we want to be part of all of that. And so we'll do that by going to these brick and mortar stores.
Now, was that, you know, if you're thinking about last Christmas, as you and other experts, as Sharice and others were thinking about what the future was going to hold, I wish I could say post-pandemic, but wherever we are right now as we get into this phase of the pandemic, was the expectation that there'd be a rush back into brick and mortar stores? I know a lot of us felt like, oh, everyone's going to order everything online for the rest of their lives we've had this experience.
Yeah, I think that everyone really thought that we would just continue to move towards the online retailing. And we are. We're looking at an increase for online retailing as well for this year. But we still have to remember in the whole picture of the dollars. So the NRF, the National Retail Federation, is saying that we'll be at about $850 billion for sales. That's the high estimation for this Christmas season. The online sales are $220 billion. So they're still a part of the whole picture, but they're not the whole picture. And we easily say, oh, everyone's just shopping online. No, you see a lot of cars in parking lots. You see a lot of merchandise in stores. And as Teresa said before, the retailers have planned to get their merchandise in earlier for this year. And you can see, like, if you're looking at a Target, there's an awful lot of trailers in their parking lots right now. And that's holding the merchandise. Mm. So where we would have had a lot of, you know, just continuous truck deliveries in years past, they've put the merchandise, they have the merchandise waiting to put into their stores.
Teresa, I saw you quoted in an article a few times. You said it's not just Black Friday anymore, it's Black November. Mm-hmm. But as we are looking, you know, people watching this at home, it's going to be post-Thanksgiving when people see this. Are they too late?
No, I actually don't think so. I think part of the reason why retailers chose to front load their deliveries, well, they always arrive early.
Yeah.
But the reason why they decided to try to pull forward demand for the Black Friday or Black November, and in fact, some even started as early as October for their what they call the Black Friday previews. Part of the reason why is to, one, to de-densify the store so we don't have such a surge in Black Friday weekend and December. But also, there's a labor shortage, so it evens out demand a little bit. You know, so it's pulling forward demand in throughout the month of November to lessen a little bit of that crunch in December. And again, these goods, whether planned or otherwise, the goods that are already here versus the goods that are constrained and caught up in the bottlenecks at the ports, they're all going to get here. So even those who wait till the last minute, there's going to be some new goods on the shelves.
I think we both have a few friends who are in the mall on Christmas Eve trying to figure out if their wife might like this here. I'm wondering, Teresa, you mentioned earlier, you talked about the things that like a Target, a Walmart, even a Gap or a Lululemon might be able to do. We also know there's many, many independent shops. There's small businesses, small retailers who clearly don't have the buying capacity to negotiate with you know, Asian container freight companies and such. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be a bit of a haves and have-nots kind of situation here where the smaller players might have a lot more trouble navigating the supply shortage? Do you think it's going to even out across the landscape?
You know, if you look at if you look at all these cargo vessels in queue waiting to get their goods offloaded, we're talking about something like 250 containers worth of goods sitting and waiting. And so those are spread across a lot of retailers. It's not just the small retailers, but the smaller retailers, yes, are going to be hurt more than those that had won the cash flow to buy goods so far in advance and charter their own vessels to bring them here. So the smaller retailers don't have that cash flow and they don't have the negotiating power. So probably going to get their goods later than others, but I think the goods are still going to come in. And so even smaller retailers will have goods available for sale. I've shopped at a few of them just to see what's in there, and you know, they still have goods on the shelf. So it's still going to be a good what do they call it? Small local shopping.
Shop local Saturday, right?
I was going to say, just to add on to that, also many of our small stores also source locally. So they're sourcing, you know, from within the United States or even within their state for many of their the products that they are selling. So they will have those products as well. So in that case, they'll be able to look at that, and and they have bought again from within the United States as well, and been able to get their product into their stores.
Well, on the second half, we're going to be talking about sourcing locally for food, and that does bring up something that's on everyone's mind. Diane, my grocery bill is comically large right now, and I think Teresa, you said at the beginning of the program, that people's wages have increased, and sure, maybe, but I don't think people's wages have increased, 6%, which is what we're seeing for inflation right now. Is my grocery bill the new reality?
Your grocery bill is the new reality. At least for the next year, your grocery bill is the new reality. And for right now, consumers are absorbing that. So we're not expecting that consumers are going to spend less for Christmas. We're expecting they're going to spend more for Christmas. And they are absorbing those higher costs.
Yeah, but not all consumers can absorb those costs.
But not all consumers can. And I also saw that credit, people using credit, has also increased. This Thanksgiving is supposed to be the most expensive Thanksgiving on record because of the food increases. This is our new reality. Right now, there's not any time, it's not coming soon, that we're going to get out of this inflation that we're in.
Hmm. Retailers are trying to do a few things to offset their cost increases so that they don't have to pass it all on to the consumers. So what you're going to find is what they call SKU rationalization. So you'll have...
That's SKU, the little thing on the...
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I worked in retail. I remember.
That little barcode, yep. Right. So you'll see a smaller assortment, a narrower assortment, because it's a lot less expensive to make more of the same product than fewer of a wider variety of products. And so you're going to see less assortment to keep the prices down. That's one way to not cut the cost increases. You'll also see fewer services offered in retail. So you may not get gift wrapping. You may not get the free boxes that you used to get. And these are ways to keep their margins in check so they don't have to pass everything on to the consumer.
Well, to your point, Teresa, I mean, you touched on it earlier. We're talking about the goods shortage a lot, but the worker shortage, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Across the economy, yes, but we know retail, a lot more entry level, there's a lot of churn in the retail labor force. How are companies, are they expecting this is going to be a lasting thing? I mean, you see, I don't think you go anywhere right now without a help wanted sign out. And $15 minimum wage, $16, $17 at some places, which good for workers, but it must be a management challenge for these retailers that are used to having a pretty full workforce on the floor at Christmas.
Right. And you've got, in the retail store, you've got the workers doing double duty because there a lot of the e-commerce fulfillment is occurring in the store. So you've got employees. I was at a Target this weekend, and there was a staff of people, they're all wearing reflective vests because they're going out and picking and packing orders and then going out for curbside delivery, BOPACs, right? Buy online, pick up at curbside. And so you've got that staff to manage, and then the few that are left are dealing with the in-store customers.
Or sometimes not being very nice, by all reports, with the fewer staff around.
Right. That has definitely been a problem. And also, Christmas and Christmas staff has always been a stress point for retailers. It always has, because you want to bring the staff in. When your sales are increasing, they don't have the training that they really need to deal with the big influx of customers coming into the store. And they easily get frustrated, and then they leave rather quickly. And this year, they might leave even quicker because there's less patience, on both sides of the counter. There's less patience.
Yeah, I remember working Black Friday at the Providence Place Mall at Borders, RIP Borders, and that was quite a tough day for the newbies to figure out with the amount of people in the store.
It always was. I would find when I worked at Filene's, sometimes on the Black Friday day, you would find the people that you just hired in the food court, and they were like, nah, no more.
They're tapped out, I remember Filene's. All right, look, we have to go to a break, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you guys about CVS, a major employer in Rhode Island based in Woonsocket. They announced they're planning to close 900 stores, obviously. across the globe. What was your reaction to that, I guess, Diane, when you heard that news, and what does it mean?
Well, when I first heard the news, I honestly wasn't surprised.
How come?
Because, first of all, CVS really grew through acquisitions. So they acquired a lot of pharmacies, and they had, which made them have a lot of CVSs within the same area. So that was one problem, that you knew that there would need to be a thinning out at some point of all of their locations. Also, they're changing. You know, they're not just that, you know, quick stop in for makeup or candy or soda. They are really moving towards health.
Right.
And being that place where the customer can come in and not only get their prescriptions, but if they have like an earache or a sore throat or something, they can get that taken care of at CVS. So they're really going in a different direction as well.
All right, Diane McCrohan, professor at Johnson & Wales University, and Teresa McCarthy Byrne, professor at Bryant University, thank you so much for joining us. And I want to tell our viewers, if you're interested in this topic, we just sort of touched on it, be sure to check out our 12 on 12 digital original that deals with the supply chain explained issue. Make sure you catch that on WPRI.com. When we come back, this is a big week for food, as we discussed. But did you know there is a whole council in Rhode Island devoted to just food policy? We'll explain that coming up on Newsmakers. Welcome back to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White, alongside 12 News Politics editor Ted Nisi. Joining us on the second half, we have Jazonda Barros, co-chair of the Rhode Island Food Policy Council, and Nessa Richmond, who is the network director of the council. Nessa, for people at home, how would you explain to them what the Rhode Island Food Policy Council is?
Sure. The Rhode Island Food Policy Council is a network-based organization that brings people together to create a more just and resilient food system for the state. And when we talk about who's involved in the food system, it's everyone from farmers and fishermen to food processors and manufacturers, aggregators and distributors, our hospitality sector with restaurants, grocery stores, and even the folks who are managing food waste.
So, Jazandra, when we think about, we talked a little bit on the first half of kind of looking locally at food production in Rhode Island, is that growing? Is it decreasing? Or what? And in what sectors? What's the outlook for food production in Rhode Island?
Yeah, I mean, we've always had a pretty strong food economy. You know, I think Rhode Island has always been known for a very long time as being like a really strong culinary destination. I don't think we're thought of as being a farming state, but
right.
We do have farms and they do produce, you know, a decent amount of food. We definitely want to increase that, and we're hoping as a part of our work on the Food Policy Council that that will actually be something that happens. But we have fishers, we have a lot of people who make food products as well. And so, yeah, it's growing, and we're hoping that it will continue to grow and be strengthened.
Nessa, I was looking at, in 2017, the state released a Rhode Island food strategy called Relish Roadie, cute name for the report. And one of the goals that really caught my eye, New England as a region, this was 2017, but I assume it's still the goal, wants to get to the point by the year 2060 where half of all food eaten in New England is produced in New England. How close are we to that right now, and kind of what steps do need to happen regionally if that goal is to be achieved?
Yes, that is a vision. So the vision of 50 by 60 is something that the region came together and developed several years ago with help from some folks at universities across the area, thinking about what can we produce here? How much can we produce here that we can really consume here? And it's hard to say how we're doing right now. I think that it's safe to say that we're probably in Rhode Island under 5% of the food that we eat being grown here in the state. But when you think about it on a regional level, we might be a little bit higher than that. So there's still a long way to go. And in terms of how to get there, well, we really have to do a lot of work in terms of understanding what our assets are, what our resources are, and then thinking about ourselves as a region. So Rhode Island is never going to be able to produce all of the land-based food that we eat here. But when you think about Vermont and the dairy, and you think about Maine and all the acreage there, there's a lot that we can do on the regional level. And of course, Rhode Island plays a really important part in that. especially our fisheries industry. We bring an enormous amount of seafood into our ports, and that's really a resource for the whole region when we think about developing a local and regional food system.
With that industry in mind, how concerned are you about the fishing regulations that are often talked about at the federal level but can't be controlled at the local level? And then, of course, there's the expansion of offshore wind farms, which often make the fishing industry nervous.
Yeah. I mean, fisheries is a highly regulated industry, and I would say that our fishermen are extremely adept at understanding and navigating all of the changes that happen, whether they're being made at the federal level, the regional level, or even the local level. So, I mean, everybody has to adapt and be responsive, but in terms of regulation here at the state level, I think the state has really done some great things during COVID to help our commercial fishermen. One of the most important things they did was to allow fishermen to sell directly to consumers. That hadn't been allowed previously, and that was a temporary regulatory change that was made during COVID, and now I understand it's a permanent regulatory change.
Jasandra, you work for the Southside Community Land Trust in Providence. You're the community outreach coordinator, so you come from that perspective, but you're also the co-chair, so I'm sure you're talking to all people in different parts of the food sector. I'm curious, you know, for people watching at home who maybe haven't thought hard about this before, what might surprise them about the food ecosystem in Rhode Island, or what have you learned from your work with the council about, you know, the diversity across the food ecosystem that you find interesting or maybe inspiring?
Yeah, I think one of the things I think Nessa kind of alluded to a little bit was just like how much seafood that we actually have, and but how little of it actually is eaten and consumed here in Rhode Island. I think it's something like 90% of the fish, the seafood that's caught in Rhode Island waters, most of it's exported. And so a lot of that is a resource, and I think that it's very underutilized, and some of the work that the council has done is trying to move that needle a little bit. A lot of the fish and seafood that people like to eat, calamari and shrimp and lobster, and we catch some of those things, but a lot of the local fish that most people are not really familiar with are some of the things that we'd like to be able to have.
We
people
should expand
have access
our,
to.
Our palate is what it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You finally get your kids to eat some weird fish. Yeah, exactly. We also want to talk about, of course, food insecurity, especially being it's Thanksgiving week. And that's another thing that I know the Food Policy Council works on along with a lot of other organizations. I'm curious to either one, whoever wants to field the question, you know, how serious is the food insecurity problem as we sit here right now? And what's the trajectory? Is it getting better between there have been federal SNAP changes and there are other efforts, or are you seeing things get worse?
Yeah. Well, we're fortunate to be sitting here the day after the Rhode Island Community Food Bank released its annual report. So we can say that in their 2020 report, they found that over a quarter of all Rhode Islanders were food insecure. In the report that they released yesterday, the number had gone down to 1 in 6, but that's still twice as high as it was before.
And concretely, for someone at home, what does it mean to be food insecure? By the way, they run the metric.
It means that you're worried about having enough food to put on the table for your family on a weekly basis. So there are a lot of specific questions that the federal government asks, you know, in its surveys, but really it boils down to making sure that, you know, feeling confident and being able to have enough food on the table, enough calories to fulfill the needs of yourself and your family members.
And what have you seen, Jasandra, working at the Southside Community Land Trust? Are you seeing on the ground, the neighborhood, an uptick in people with food insecurity? Has it seemed similar to how it's been throughout the pandemic?
I mean, the stats are good. I think a part of food insecurity that isn't talked about, so yes, it is worrying about having enough food. I think the part that gets kind of left off of the table is just being able to make choices around food. So you might be able to get food, but it might not be the kind or the amount that you want and need for your family. And so I've seen, you know, gratefully not personally, but I know that there are a lot of folks who, one, like fresh produce, like that continues to be a challenge, and that's part of like the food insecurity piece that we're trying to address, is that like people want fresh fruits and vegetables, they want to feed it to their families, and the work that we do is really around like how do we make sure that people have access to that, and that it's affordable.
Now, so we have about a minute left in the program here, and we were talking about retail on the first half, and it did make me wonder, If local food producers can penetrate the big stores locally, you know, you think about buying a cucumber at Stop and Shop, and often, you know, things are grown in Mexico, whatever. Are they penetrating, you know, into the Stop and Shops and the other major markets in the area?
Well, I think that really depends on who the buyers are for the stores and the relationships that they have, you know, with the producers. So we do have some significant sizable producers here in Rhode Island, and they build relationships, and that's why in season you will see local corn and you'll see local apples maybe when you go in right now. But we don't produce, you know, we don't have produce all year round. You know, we have the winter season when things get really reduced and have to be grown in hoop houses and other types of greenhouses. So, I mean, I think when you get outside of the big grocery stores, then you can go to the smaller stores, and that's where you can really find those direct relationships with producers and even with farmers themselves.
Nessa Richmond, Gisondo Barros, thank you so much for joining us. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. We'll see you next week on News.